Books for the Young at Heart today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. John Ripslinger was one of Roald's students years ago. We'll find out if he learned anything, then hear what Garrison Keillor can teach us about the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. You know, that's a burden you'll have to carry throughout your life, John. You were a student of Roald Tweet's.
The image I have, John was in the regional studies program when Augustana had that Master of Arts, you know, for teachers. And the one, every time I think of John Ripslinger, or I see his name in the paper out at a book signing at Barnes & Noble's, I remember a scene. We were at Pere Marquette State Park on a field trip. And we were eating in the shelter, and it was raining like mad, and a gloomy day, and that rain was coming down in sheets over the edge of the roof. And there John stood with his plate and his cup and his silverware down on the ground being washed by the rain with a glum look on his face. So every time I think of you, John, I don't think of you as a writer. I think of you as wondering what in the world you've ever gotten into.
Well, he's clean.
Well, but you've become famous since then as Joy Ripslinger's grandpa.
Yes. Nobody knows that I'm a writer, but they know that I'm the grandfather of Joy Ripslinger, who is now at the University of Arkansas with a full ride and track.
Yeah, she really has come a long way. Well, I did not know when I had you in class that you were – I knew you were a teacher, but I didn't know you were a writer. When did you start writing? These are teen novels or adolescent – what do you call them?
These are young adult novels.
Young adult, okay.
And when I was in your class, I wasn't writing at all. I was simply teaching and working part-time at the Quad City Times. And I really didn't have time to devote to writing novels. But in the late 1980s, I read a novel written by Judy Blume titled Forever. And I thought to myself, I think I can do that. I think I can write a book like this because I'm an English teacher. I know how to write sentences. I know how to write paragraphs. I can punctuate. And I think probably I could write a novel like Judy Blume's Forever. And I didn't get a chance to really start until I got close to retiring because I didn't have enough time. But after I retired in 1994, I devoted practically all of my free time trying to become a novelist, and it's turned out pretty well. I've published 10 young adult novels, and I'm pretty happy about that.
I would guess so. What is it about newspaper work that helps form you as a writer?
Well, you have to be, as a newspaper writer, you have to be curious about the people that you're covering, and you have to be precise, and you have to learn to write under pressure. I wasn't really a newspaper writer. I worked on the desk with Jerry Bretag and John O'Donnell and Jerry Jurgens, and mainly I took telephone calls, and once in a while I would write short headlines, and occasionally I would write a short basketball or football story that came in over the telephone. So I wasn't really a full-fledged sports reporter, you might say. I was just part-time employee while I was at college.
But still, the pressure of newspapers impresses itself on everyone. You have to get the stuff done. You have to get it turned out.
You have to get it precisely, and you have to get it. You have to get it quickly.
So, how quick a writer are you when you turn to an adolescent novel?
It takes me usually about 6 months to write a young adult novel. I have a copy of Desperate here, which I'm going to read from perhaps a little later. And I did some checking this morning before I arrived here, and I started this book on August 1st, 2005. And I finished on February 23rd, 2006. So it took me about 6 months to write the rough draft. However, the book was rejected 33 times. mainly because I was submitting to agents and high class publishers like HarperCollins, which publishes a lot of teen novels, and the book was finally accepted by an independent publisher on the second try, and it was published July 17th, 2017.
What's an independent publisher?
An independent publisher will take your manuscript at no cost to you. Take your manuscript, proofread it, edit it, provide a cover, and publish it with no cost to you. And you sign a contract for 5 years, and they will you split the profits with the publisher. I get 50% of the real retail price, and the independent publisher also gets 50% of the retail price.
That is a good deal.
I had no idea there was such a thing.
Yeah. Yes, it is a good deal. I don't have a penny invested in this book, except that I have to help promote the book. In fact, I spend a lot of time on Facebook, on Google, on Twitter, trying to promote the book, because the independent publisher does not have contacts with bookstores throughout the country like Barnes & Noble, and it doesn't have contacts with libraries throughout the country either. So the only place you can buy the book is online at Amazon or at Barnes & Noble, and there are some other sites also. You can buy the book from the publisher's website also.
Mm-hmm. That you mentioned, you know, working on this for 6 months, and you said something about reading from the book. Why don't you read a little bit so we have an idea of something of your style and something of the character of the book?
In this book, Buddy O'Neill has fallen in love with a bisexual girl who is involved with two lesbian girls. And his girlfriend, Crystal Crow, and one of her lovers, Leslie, have murdered one of the girls, and they have asked Buddy McNeil to help them dispose of the body. And this is the scene where Buddy discovers what has happened and what his, I should say, ex-girlfriend Crystal Crow and her friend Leslie have done. I ask, is this supposed to be a big party? Where is everybody? Crystal shrugs. Just us. Whose place is this? Julie's grandma's, Crystal says. It's empty. She's in a nursing home, and Julie's mom is selling it. Crystal's lips twist into a smile. Did you bring some beer and wine? Where's the other stuff? Truth is, I brought a 12-pack of beer and a bottle of red wine, a camping saw, and trash bags like I'd promised. It's all locked in my car's trunk. but after viewing this scene, I decide that's where it's going to stay. Something's wrong here. Where's Julie? We need a saw, Crystal says. We found a shovel in the garage up the hill, but couldn't find a saw. Did you bring some beer and wine? We need trash bags, too. Goosebumps creep over me. My eyes darting all around, I ask, where's Julie? Over there, Leslie says, matter-of-factly, pointing beyond the bonfire. The coyotes yap again. A knot clutches in my stomach. On the ground, Crystal says, pointing to the in the same direction. Over there on the ground. Swallowing once more, hair bristling on the back of my neck, I step away from the fire so I can see what's on the other side. I peer into the gloom. All I see is a lump on the ground, an indefinite, irregular, dark shape. I feel myself breathing harder than I need to be. I'm afraid I know why. I creep around the fire and find a girl with short, spiky blonde hair lying face down in the grass. She's dressed in khaki pants and a long-sleeved camo shirt. As a chill races through me, I'm trembling all over. I drop to my knees. I take a couple of breathless breaths. The corners of my mouth twitch. I turn the girl over. She's heavy. It's Julie. But I knew that. What the hell's happened to her, I say? She's drunk already and passed out? OD'd? I'm hoping beyond hope that what I said is true. She's OD'd. She's not dead. I stare at Crystal and Leslie, standing in the other side of the fire, across in black jean jackets and black jeans, the flames blazing in front of them, their hair streaked with purple and pink. They look like creatures from hell, witches, vampires. She's dead, Leslie says, with no sign of emotion. I sit back on my heels. My skin tingles. Goosebumps arrive again, exploding across my body. The knot in my stomach gives a terrible twist. I can't breathe. Crystal hands the roach to Leslie, who takes a deep drag, then gives the butt back to Crystal. She's dead, Leslie says, and presses her hands against her cheek. Like her face is crumbling, she needs to hold it together so it doesn't fall to the ground in pieces. She's dead. She's dead. She's dead. Leslie's words sound like a chant. I stare at Julie. I feel woozy. Nausea quivers in my stomach. The left side of her head appears dented. Blood clumps cling to her blonde hair on that side. My heart's pounding like a mallet against my chest. I'm close to puking. We need you to help us saw her body up, Crystal says. She shuffles toward me, leans down and blinks at me through the hair in her eyes. And to carry everything back up the hill. Where's the saw and bags? Did you bring the beer and wine? Red wine?
This is not your average Bobbsey Twin story, is it?
No. Are all your stories problematic like this for... These are challenging, I would think, for... Well, this is based on a real local sensational murder case. I mean, I recognize the details right there, but...
This is the original idea of two girls killing a third girl and sawing the body up and asking a boy to help dispose of the body. That original idea came from the Sarah Kolb,
right,
and Andrea Reynolds murder, and so I took that as something startling, and tried to weave my own story around that incident.
Well, I like the way in which the grisly details are interspersed with, you know, it sounds true to life. You know, Did you bring the saw to saw her up with? Did you bring the beer and wine? You know, I mean, as if there were no difference.
Yeah, there's a coldness there that...
just not understanding either.
Yeah.
I mean, were they really aware of what they were doing?
Yeah. You've bitten off quite a subject there, John.
Now, are all your books like this? I did go out and get the first one when you appeared at Barnes & Noble, and I did go out and buy the first one, and I haven't seen you since then, but...
Most of them are like that. For example, I took the idea of the Jim Clint murder of his wife, Joyce Clint, and used that for a basis of a story of a husband sawing up his wife and throwing the pieces into the Mississippi River. And I wondered how would a boy react if he found out that his dad actually did that? And what gave me special reason to be interested in that story is that Jim Clint's son, Bart Clint, was a friend of my son, Jeff Ripslinger, and they played football together at Frank L. Smart and then later at West High School. And so I knew Bart Clint, the son of Jim, and I often wondered, man, how does a boy live with the thought that his dad killed his mom? And so that was the basis of a story that I titled Missing Pieces, although I did not try to tell the true story of the Jim Clint murder.
Before we run out of time here, John, you are at work promoting your books. Do you have book signings? You have blogs and so on. How does one find out more about your work?
Well, the books are sold at Amazon, as I said, and Barnes & Noble's online. I've had book signings at Barnes & Noble, but my most two recent book signings were at a tavern in the west end of Davenport named Jimmy O's.
Uh-huh.
And I tell you, I used to sell maybe 14, 15, 20 books at Barnes & Noble, which was good. But my last book signing for Desperate at Jimmy O's Tavern, I sold 48 books.
My goodness.
To whom?
To friends, to my relatives, to my friends in the West End in the Davenport, and mainly to ex-students who had me as a teacher at West High School. I taught there for 33 years. Mm-hmm. And so the next book signing that I have, I think I'll do it at a tavern again.
Get them drunk.
We have a new site here for literature. John Ripslinger, thank you very much for taking time to visit with us. You obviously are working a very profitable vein in writing.
May I say thank you for having me? I'm greatly surprised to be here, and I'm happy to be here on a public radio station. I think it's a thrill.
You've written more books than the both of us put together, so.
I tell you, John, you're no more surprised to be here than we are. Well, that's quite a story.
Yeah. Amazing guy.
Yeah. And, you know, departing from things that actually happen, you think, this is a pretty grim world.
Well, a lot of, I was afraid they would be kind of romances, but they're not.
Not a whole lot of romance.
No.
But it'd be interesting to look further into his books.
Yes, I think they're certainly worth doing.
Look further into your book bag there.
Well, as you know, I am a sucker for books that take place in bookstores.
I And know that you're a sucker for bookstores.
I'm a sucker for bookstores, and I love books about mysteries that take place in bookstores. A lot of mysteries do take place in bookshops.
Hmm.
But Susan Kivistow, several weeks ago, gave me a book that I had never heard of called The Little Paris Bookshop by Gina George. The proprietor, Jean Perdu, is 50 years old, and his bookstore is called A Literary Apothecary. It's on a barge in the Seine River in Paris. And what he does, it's called A Literary Apothecary. What he does is prescribe books. People come in and he talks to them, and he has a real ability to psych out what they might need intellectually, emotionally, or spiritually. And so after talking to them for 5 minutes, you know, they may pick up a book, and he said, no, you don't want that book. Here's the book you want. And he prescribes books. And not only does he prescribe books, but he says, only 50 pages a day. It's wonderful, right? You know, because I've done that. And people have prescribed books to me. You've just got to read this because, you know, what you need is this book. And he's always right on the money. The problem is he's not very good at prescribing books for himself. You do get a lot of good book titles in this book. I mean, you know, because he hands these books out. He won't sell a book if you're not the kind that needs it, right? Only. But the story is that 20 years before the book opens, the love of his life, with whom he'd been living but not married to, he woke up one morning and she was gone, presumably back home, someplace on the coast of France. And he seals off the room in which she lived, including her table, in which there's a drawer. And as the scene opens, he's about to give the table to somebody who's in need of some furniture, a woman that's moved into his apartment building. And she opens the drawer, and there's a letter in there from the woman that left him 20 years ago, which he's never discovered and never opened.
Hmm.
And he finally decides, I've got to open this letter and find out what happened. And what that letter contains sends him on a restless voyage from Paris down rivers and canals toward her home on the coast, selling books along the way, and assembling a cast of characters. It's wonderful. And I can't tell you what the letter says because that's the whole of the book.
Well, you can't leave me just hanging like this, Tweet.
Well, in the letter, she says that she's leaving him because she has only several months to live.
Oh.
And she doesn't want to hurt him.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So she didn't walk out on him. And he's got to find out what happens. And it's a sad, funny, you know, ultimately not a serious, deep book, but it is really delightful. The Little Paris Bookshop by Gina George.
Well, okay. That sounds intriguing.
It is. It is really a good read.
And I hope you're intrigued enough to join us next week. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. We'll see you on the next edition of Scribble.